I wanted to talk about something different this week, since we're starting a new Torah cycle, and I thought this, I've been actually wanting to do this for a long time, but I felt it'd be best to do it at the beginning of the Torah cycle, because this is something that would help us to understand some various aspects of the Torah that we probably are not aware of. And we talked about Code of Hammurabi a number of years back, but not to this extent. So we're going to talk about this today, and we'll explain what this is all about. And hopefully, by the end of this this little teaching here, we'll get a little bit better understanding of some of the influences on the Torah. Now, through the ages, there's been a number of attempts to discount the authenticity of the Bible and the existence of Yahweh, the God of Israel. These attempts include the presumed lack of evidence of the greatness of the kingdom of Israel, questions about the historical flood, and of course, there's been evolution. Another attempt that was made through the ages is that Moses and the code of law that he wrote, in other words, the Torah, simply could not have existed since ancient cultures did not have written codes of law. This was something that was a commonly accepted thing years ago, that these ancient cultures did not have codes of law, and therefore Moses could not have had one. So thus, therefore, the whole book, the whole Bible basically is a legend or a novel, and that when, you know, the code of law, when there were codes of law, that's when it was written. But the conclusion was destroyed in 1901 with the archaeological discovery of the Code of Hammurabi. Or, actually, it's Hammurabi. I actually got it spelled wrong up there. 1901. Hammurabi is how you say it, and I've used to say it all the time, Hammurabi, and I was wrong, so I may revert back to that. Anyway, this is Hammurabi. He was an ancient Mesopotamian king. Now, Mesopotamia is Babylon, okay? He ruled Babylon during one of his most successful ages from roughly 1792 BCE to 1750 BCE. That's a long time ago. Roughly the same time that Abraham was called out of Ur of the Chaldees. Basically, he was a contemporary with Abraham. Archaeologists have found that this period of Babylon's history is rich in culture with vibrant trade throughout the area. The people were educated, as evidenced by the fact that practically in every home that they've unearthed during that period of time, they've found things written on pottery and stuff like that. So they presumed that the people during that day and age could actually read, and that they could write, obviously. They're also quite advanced mathematically. They found that some of these artifacts they've discovered had mathematical formulas that were only recently rediscovered, maybe 100 to 150 years ago. So they obviously were quite advanced. During his reign, Hammurabi controlled practically everything between the Persian Gulf and the Mediterranean Sea. Now, if we look back at the promise given to Abraham, that was basically the same land that was promised to Abraham. So, there's some things quite coincidental. There again, he was a contemporary of Abraham. He controlled the land that basically God promised to Abraham later on. As king, Hammurabi came up with a code of law that contained 282 individual laws pertaining to many aspects of life, including civil and criminal litigation, marriage, family relations, wages, and property. Hammurabi claimed that his code was given to him by the Babylonian god Shamash, and a lot of people take this because there was a Babylonian god named Shamash. A lot of people believe that the Shamash on the Hanukkah is pagan. By the way, I'll just throw that in there. Yet surprisingly, it contained no laws pertaining to the worship of or allegiance to any Babylonian god. So Hammurabi's code included laws pertaining to all these various things in regards to social life, but had no religious laws at all. The code was found written on a 7-foot-tall granite stone that's in the shape of an index finger, and which is what you see there. It was discovered in Iran, where it had been taken as plunder during a later conquest. The when the Babylonian Empire fell back then, the stone and these things were taken and moved to Iran. Now, why is this important to us? Why is it important that we know a little bit about the Code of Hammurabi? There are three reasons. First, it proves that there is indeed a code of law in existence during the time of Moses and the Torah. So that dispels the theory that the Bible was a legend because of the fact that Moses could not have had a written code of law. If Hammurabi had a code of law, and they know it now, and it was 300 years prior to Moses, then that argument is gone. It also provides keys to understanding why Yahweh gave certain laws to Moses. We'll see from the Code of Hammurabi that there are certain reasons why God, or I would suggest that there are certain reasons why God gave certain laws in the Torah. And it may give us an insight into what the Jewish people call oral Torah. We'll talk about all three of these today to see if they actually do have any bearing on our understanding of God's law. Well, shortly after the discovery of Hammurabi's code in 1901, many theories were introduced as to whether the Torah was a takeoff of the Code of Hammurabi. Now that the argument was gone, that there couldn't be that Moses could not have written a biblical code, now all of a sudden they're starting to say, okay, well, Moses didn't write it, he copied it from Hammurabi, okay? And the reason they thought that is because there's similar laws in each. We'll look at some of these similar laws. Take, for instance, the case of a false witness. And we'll just go through some of these similar laws. In the Bible, or in Hammurabi's code, it says this. If a man brings an accusation against a man and charges him with capital crime, but cannot prove it, he, the accuser, shall be put to death. Okay, does that sound similar to a Torah edict? And another code here, and this is code number 3, I just listed these in the same order that they are found in the code. If a man in a case pending judgment bear false or threatening witness or does not establish the testimony that he has given, in that case, if that case being a case involving life, that man shall be put to death. In other words, if a person is going to testify against somebody in a capital offense, if the testimony of the accuser cannot be substantiated, then the accuser is put to death. That's basically what it's saying. And we see something very similar to that in the Torah. In Exodus 20, verse 16, it says, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And in Deuteronomy 19, 16, it says, if a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before Yahweh, before the priests and the judges who serve in those days. And the judges shall make careful inquiry. And indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to you, to his brother. So you shall put away the evil among you. So if the false witness was testifying falsely, in a capital case, in other words, his desire was that this person be put to death, then God's law says that he be put to death himself, right? And this parallels Hammurabi's code. Okay, there's a similar thing in the case of kidnapping. In Hammurabi's code, it says if a man steals a man's son who is a minor, he shall be put to death. In the Torah, it says he who kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he is found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. So in both of these cases, a person is put to death for kidnapping, which was also the law here in the United States up until recently. One more example is that of a person who sells himself or one of his family members into slavery in order to pay debts. In Hammurabi's code, it says if a man be in debt and sells his wife, son, or daughter and bind them over to service, for 3 years they shall work in the house of their purchaser or master. In the fourth year they shall be given their freedom. Now Hammurabi is a little bit more lenient in this regard than Yahweh is, because in the Torah it says if your brother, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you and serves for 6 years, then in the seventh year you shall let him go free. So there's 3 years in Hammurabi's code of service and 6 years in God's code of service. There are a number of other similar cases, but the one that stands out the most is that of life for life, limb for limb. We've talked about that some here in our fellowship. In Hammurabi's code, this is stated in a series of laws. And this is really quite interesting and quite important. It says, let me see. Let's Did I slip forward one? No. Okay. I just apparently left that out. All right. So we'll look. You can look in Hammurabi's code if you want to. It's code like 160, 162, 164, something like that. And I'll just tell you real briefly what it says. It basically says that in Hammurabi's code, it says if a person does damage to you physically, then you should damage the person back in like mind. And it actually still uses the terms eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand. All right. And there again, this is parallel to what the Torah says in Exodus 21. If men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished accordingly as a woman's husband imposes on him. And he shall pay as the judge determines. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, and stripe for stripe. Okay, later in the Torah, this is actually extended to one who does bodily harm to his neighbor. Okay, this is in regards to a woman who gets hurt. But it's extended even further in Leviticus 24. If a man causes disfigurement to his neighbor, as he has done so shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. As he has caused disfigurement of a man, so shall it be done to him. And whoever kills an animal shall restore it, but whoever kills a man shall be put to death. You shall have the same law for the stranger and the one for your own country, for I am Yahweh your God. Okay. And I apologize for not having the Hammurabi's code up there because I had it, but I just didn't bring it with me. When you compare Hammurabi's code to Yahweh's code, they look very similar. But there is one big significant difference to this code. And that is, in Hammurabi's code, there is a caste system. And it basically works like this. And if you had seen the slide I had before there, it says, if you are a man, then it's eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Okay? But then it says, in the very next code, it says, if you are a free man, then it is a payment is made monetarily for the eye. And then it says in the third code pertaining to this, it says, if you are a slave, then a lesser payment is made. So basically, it has established a caste system in Hammurabi's code, where if you are equal with the person who did damage to you, then it's eye for eye. But if you are you're a prominent businessman, and then maybe a common person is the one who puts your eye out, then that person, or you put the eye out of a common person, then that common person is only given compensation. And then if you're a slave one of the king's princes or something like that puts the eye out of somebody, then that slave is only given a pittance. Okay? So there's a clear caste system in Hammurabi's code. But in God's law, well, here it is. Okay. Let's just look at this. In Hammurabi's code, the bottom line is this: the lowest person on the totem pole who would be slaves, who is probably a captain of war, would get a very low compensation for the loss of his eye. But a person who's really high on the totem pole would get a very high compensation. Again, you can look at the eye for eye. Because in the slide that I left out, it talks about a man. But in this one here, number 198, it says, if one destroy the eye of a free man, or break the bone of a free man, he shall pay one mana of silver. Okay? And then if one destroy the eye of a slave or break a bone of a slave, he shall pay one half his price, one half of the cost of the slave. So what you're seeing here is a caste system that exists within Hammurabi's code in regards to eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. If you're not a man, and the term for man is not a man versus woman, it is, in many of these Hebrew cultures, men were only men of prominence. If you were not a man of prominence, you were not a man. Everyone else was less than a man. Okay? So this is sort of the way it worked in a lot of these ancient cultures. But the big difference between Hammurabi's code and God's code is this. Again, going back to the Leviticus passage, if a man causes disfigurement of his neighbor, or a fracture, or it's eye for eye, tooth for tooth, and whoever kills an animal shall restore it, but whoever kills a man shall be put to death. But the big difference is this. You shall have the same law for the stranger and from one from your own country. For I am Yahweh your God. In other words, God totally eliminates a caste system. Whatever, if the President of the United States puts out the law of a slave, or the eye of a slave, then vice versa should happen. The eye of the President of the United States should be put out. That's the way, you know, theoretically, it would work, because there is no caste system in God's law. So, all right, so the problem, though, is this. The Bible does not ever talk about disfigurement of another person. In fact, it's a sin to disfigure your body, right? It's wrong to disfigure your body. It's wrong. If it's wrong for you to disfigure your own body, put, you know, markings on it or something like that, then it would be wrong for someone to disfigure your body as well. And that would seem somewhat logical. And so this eye for eye, tooth for tooth thing can be explained a little bit different way, and I think a way that could help us to understand things a little bit better. In order to provide for equal justice between the classes, Yahweh removed the literal eye-for-eye practice found in Hammurabi's code and replaced it with remuneration of similar value. God makes this very clear in his early instructions given on Mount Sinai, and that's right here. We read through this before. If men fight and hurt a woman with a child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished according to what the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. You don't go out and kill a person because the woman lost her child. But any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound. Okay, how can you do this? How can you give eye for eye, tooth for tooth in the case of a woman who loses her child? I mean, I guess you can go out, and if your wife has a child, you can take it and cause her to miscarry or something like that, right? But that doesn't sound very biblical, does it? Doesn't sound like the mind of God at all. The rabbis understand this passage to mean that instead of putting out the eye of the offender, which in no way helps the offended, I mean, think about it. If someone puts your eye out, have you gained anything by putting their eye out? No. Okay. It's sort of like the argument today. If I feel like I'm taxed too much, does it help me by taxing another person? It doesn't, really. I mean, you gain nothing. And so the rabbis believe that eye for eye, tooth for tooth had nothing to do with actually disfiguring a person, but remuneration, because that way the person who is offended is helped, right? If I put your eye out and now you're no longer, like Greg is a graphic artist, he's no longer able to see to do his work, then him putting my eyes out is not going to help him work. But what would help him it would be to take and pay him a monetary fund. Okay? Pay him a certain amount of money, right? Retirement, is that all you want? And this is the way the rabbis believed it. This was the question that arose in the first century because of the differences in the way the Pharisees and the Sadducees interpreted the Torah. Now, what was the big difference between the Pharisees and the Sadducees in their interpretation of Torah? You remember? Well, that's true, but...
The Pharisees wouldn't go to the prophets or any of the writings. Right.
The Pharisees believed that you could get interpretation from Torah by reading between the lines, basically. Whereas the Sadducees looked at the Bible literally. What the words say is what the words do. So if the Bible says eye for eye, tooth for tooth, they believe that if I put your eye out, then you should put my eye out. If I were to accidentally cut your hand off, you should cut my hand off. That's the way the Sadducees would have looked at it because they looked at the Bible. Every word is literal. There's no Peshat, Remez, Sod, and what's the other? Drosh in it. And this is the question that you had in the first century. And I would submit to you that Yeshua agreed with the Pharisees. In Matthew 5:38, it says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also." How can we understand that? First, if you understand that the Code of Hammurabi stated that a literal eye for eye, tooth for tooth took place, and that the Sadducees also understood a literal eye for eye, tooth for tooth took place, but that the Pharisees believed that it was not a literal, but instead it was something that could really do some good, and that a person pay another person, then you can understand this passage. And there's another reason we can understand this passage. All we have to do is look to the Greek. Because when our King James Bibles, it says, "Do not resist an evil person," okay? So we think that we're not to resist someone who is bad, okay? But that's not what the Bible says. That's not what the Greek says. The Greek says, you shall not resist a hardship. Those two words, evil person, come out of the single word, Greek word, poneros, which means hardship. And all this is saying is that if you as a believer have harmed somebody, then you pay what the judges have said to pay and add a little bit to it. That's all it's saying. You do what the judges have said because that's what the Torah says to do, and you add a little bit to it. In other words, when they slap you in the face, that's not a literal slap in the face. That's a legal term. If they slap a lawsuit on you, we've all used that term before, heard that term before. If they slap a lawsuit on you because you have harmed somebody, then you take and make it good and add a little bit to it. Isn't that the way restitution works in the Torah? You don't pay just exactly what you've taken from somebody. You add to it, right? So all Yeshua was doing in this regard was he was supporting the Torah. Because in the Torah, restitution is never equal. Restitution is always a little bit more than what you took from the person that you harmed. Okay. So this is one of the things that you can see, and you can sort of get a better understanding of this from understanding the Code of Hammurabi. There are numerous other areas where this caste system comes into play in Hammurabi's code. Now, there again, the caste system was an equal thing. It was eye for eye, but it was only dependent on what your status was and all that stuff. And this is something I believe that God hates, any type of caste system. Okay, so the Hammurabi's code had this. We can show that the Bible is different, though. There is no caste system. Now, there are some who say that Hammurabi's code is the basis of the Torah, and we talked about that earlier. And I disagree with that for a number of reasons, but the caste system that is found throughout Hammurabi's system is one of the main reasons why I think it's wrong. Now, so if the code is not the basis for the Torah, what does it do for us? I believe it helps us to understand why Yahweh gave certain laws that seem to have little significance. Why there are laws that don't really have any real significance to God's people or anything. But to understand why these laws were addressed, we have to understand the way cultures work. Nations and cultures develop and often bring with them laws that were in existence long before they themselves became a nation. And our nation is a good example of that. The United States Constitution is a conglomeration of a number of laws, including British common law, the Magna Carta, and the Torah. You take all of these together and numerous other things, and you have what has become our Constitution. So we've drawn from previous cultures to basically create our culture. And our founding fathers were influenced by all those things that came before them. And then the responsibility of the founding fathers then was to take from all these laws and decide, okay, this is not good for us, or that part's not good for us, so we're going to leave those out, we're going to create other laws to add to it, and we're going to come up with a code of law that applies to us. Right? And obviously, the Torah is not part of the things that they found fault in. In fact, our founding fathers were very much pro-Torah. But they came up with a code of law that a free society could live with, and they hoped would sustain our free society. When the Israelites came out of Egypt, they were steeped in Egyptian law. I mean, they'd lived there for, what, 200 years? 170, 200 years? They were steeped in Egyptian law, which one could presume descended from the Code of Hammurabi, because the Code of Hammurabi was the prevalent law in that day and age. Knowing that the Israelites' culture coming out of Egypt was based on their understanding of Hammurabi's code, Yahweh began to correct their understanding and make a clear distinction between that code of law, the Hammurabi code of law, and his code of law, the Torah. Thus we have laws like this. In Deuteronomy 21, 15, 17, it says, if a man has two wives, one loved and the other unloved, and they have borne him children, both the loved and the unloved, and if the firstborn son is of her who is unloved, then it shall be on the day he bequeaths his possessions to his sons that he must not bestow firstborn status on the son of the loved wife in preference to the son of the unloved, the true firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the unloved wife as the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. Now, why did God give that? Now, you know, there could be a number of reasons why God gave that. But I would submit that one of the reasons why God gave that is because of the Code of Hammurabi and what it did, because in the Code of Hammurabi, it was possible for a man to show preference to his favorite son, not necessarily his firstborn son. And because in God's society, God was going to take and give special responsibility to the firstborn, then God also wanted the firstborn to receive a double portion, basically, is what God wanted him to have. But there again, Hammurabi's code allowed for favoritism. And so if the firstborn wasn't the favorite son, then in Hammurabi's code, it could be the second, third, fourth, fifth son. And that son could be the favorite son, and he could get a large portion of the inheritance. And this is the way it reads in the code. If a man present field, garden, or house to his favorite son and write for him a sealed deed after the father's father dies, when the brothers divide, he shall take the present which the father gave him, and over and above, they shall divide the goods of the father's house equally. In other words, say the father likes this fourth-born son for some reason. And he says, all right, fourth-born son, I'm going to give you the house, the barn, all the chickens, all the horses, and all the cows. That's your inheritance. And then when he dies, the only thing left is two pigs. The fourth-born son gets the house, the barn, horses, the cows, the chickens, and then the four other kids divide up the two pigs. All right? That's the way it worked in Hammurabi's code. But that's not the way God intended it to be. So God made law to correct this problem that was found in the Hammurabi Code. Now, Hammurabi's Code can also help us to understand a little bit about Jewish oral law. The rabbis are not too fond of Hammurabi. They often identify him in the Bible as Amraphel, which is a person we find in Genesis 14, verse 1. He is one of the kings that went up against Abraham, one of the five kings. And they believe, the rabbis believe, that Hammurabi was Amraphel, and they believe that Amraphel was Nimrod. And the reason they believe that Amraphel was Nimrod and that Hammurabi was Nimrod is because Hammurabi in Hebrew means the great ham. Okay, Hammurabi, what does Rav mean? The great rabbi, the great person. And Ham is ham, okay? So they look at this and they say, okay, he was the great Ham, or he was the great descendant of Ham. That's basically the way they interpret it. And of course, Ham was Nimrod's grandfather. But Hammurabi's Code, along with the discovery of other ancient Near Eastern codes of law, has shown us that the people in these eras were more advanced than what we previously believed. Okay, I'm ahead of myself. Right. The Jews, the rabbis teach that oral tradition was developed, or actually given to Moses, because the Torah does not define how to do certain things. Okay, for instance, the Torah does not define how to kill the Passover lamb. And so the rabbis say, well, that was given to Moses and it was passed down orally. The rabbis will say that the Torah does not define various things about sacrifice or various things about how to do the sotah or thing like that, the bitter waters thing. And so they say that all of these things were given to Moses and then they were handed down in oral law. And thus we have the Mishnah and the Talmud, which is volumes and volumes of instructions on how to do these things. But what we have found out from the study of throughout archaeology and the study of these ancient cultures is that these ancient cultures were quite advanced in many of these things. And we know from the Torah, especially the story of Abraham, that sacrifice was part of their culture, everyday culture. And so Abraham didn't need the oral law to learn how to sacrifice. He just knew how to do it. And all these other cultures knew how to do these things. And so it was not necessary to have a written code of law to help them to understand these things. These were already part of their culture. And again, little is said about sacrifices, but yet in the Torah, but yet these ancient cultures already did these things. And this is some of the things we find in the Code of Hammurabi and some of the other ancient Near Eastern codes that are being discovered at, you know, even later than that. They've helped us to see that these things were very prevalent in those days. Okay. Another thing that we see here is that God corrected things in these cultures that were not in line with His way of thinking. For instance, we know that many of the ancient sacrificial cultures were fertility-based cultures, fertility-based sacrifices. And so what God does is He corrects some of these things. And Exodus 20, verse 25 is one of them. He says, if you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stone, for if you use your tool on it, you have profaned it. And then in Exodus 28, and you shall make for them linen trousers to cover their nakedness, that they shall reach from the waist to the thighs. In other words, God says, you know, I don't want any fertility rites associated with my sacrifices, so therefore you guys clothe yourselves to eliminate any possibility of that. And then, of course, Exodus 20, verse 26, you shall not go up by steps to my altar that your nakedness may not be exposed. So God, he did these things. He gave us these laws, and I would suspect that some of these laws were given to correct the problems that were found in the code of Hammurabi and the other ancient Near Eastern cultures. So Yahweh corrects the incorrect practices found in these cultures, but leaves other things unsaid. And I would suspect that there are already laws in these ancient cultures that pertain to many of the practices found in the oral law. So basically what I'm saying is this, is that if evidence can be found in these ancient codes of these things already taking place, there's no need for an oral Torah, because the oral Torah was devised, they say, to define these things that the Torah does not give. So, in conclusion, Hammurabi's code was not the basis of the Torah. I think we can see that very clearly. We can find answers to many questions in the Torah by examining these ancient codes of law. And there's other codes. There's the Hittite codes of law that have a lot to do with covenant practices. And I think those were followed very clearly in the Torah. And third is that some of the laws found in the Torah were probably given to correct the incorrect practices of the day. And, of course, one of those incorrect practices that I didn't touch on was polygamy. It was a bad system, so God addresses a bad system in the Torah in order to tell the people, you know, if you're going to practice this, this is how you're going to do it. Okay? He didn't condone it. He just corrected it. Not safe. So, with that, that's it. Any questions on any of this?